Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, welcome everybody. This is Dick Staub, host of the Kindling's Muse, and I thank you for joining us tonight. You know, I live on Orcas Island, and I was recently asked to write an introduction to a cookbook of recipes from Orcas Islanders. And the introduction went something like this. On Orcas, you'll see bumper stickers with slogans like, "Know your farmer, know your food." Fresh crab, salmon, ling cod, fruits, vegetables, locally grass-fed beef and lamb. The Northwest bounty is ours, and meals are a sacrament of their own. So enjoy the recipes in this book, savor the taste, and imagine the warm smiles of the contributors, happy that they made your day. Well, tonight we're going to take a look at Michael Pollan's best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. What happens when an investigative reporter takes on our national eating disorder? Isn't it odd to be eating a meal over this discussion tonight? I hope you've all enjoyed your meal. Quickly, finish it. Pollan says that the way we eat represents our most profound engagement with the natural world. And I've traveled to over 50 countries, and I've seen how people deal with food in other cultures. And America is somewhat unique in our relationship, or Pollan would say lack of relationship with food. We're going to have an interesting conversation tonight. He believes that the way we eat represents our most profound engagement with the natural world. And unlike people on Orcas Island, he believes the typical American is disengaged from most of their food. Our guests tonight are Mark Canlis, who is the owner of Canlis Restaurant. And let's have a big round of applause for Mark tonight. Thank you. The Reverend Jenny Spohr, producer of the Kindling's Muse, film critic, ordained Presbyterian clergy, and an eater.
And a baker.
And a big-time baker, who, when I first met Jenny, her dream was to do a radio show, a weekly radio show on manners and etiquette. And coming from the broadcasting world, awesome. I told her, not going to work. Dr. Jeff Kuse, have I mentioned tenured professor at Seattle Pacific University? And engaging interpreter of theology in popular culture. And the book is Omnivore's Dilemma. And accompanying book, is our movie, is Food, Inc., interesting subject. Well, Jenny, you wanted to do this show. What made you want to do this so much?
I did. Well, I
you like to people
as you
to
mentioned,
feel guilty.
I like to, yes, I'm very very Calvinist, and I want you all to feel guilty about everything all the time. No.
Read this
exactly,
book.
Exactly. Read this book and never eat again. No, I've always been kind of a foodie and was raised in a house where things were made from scratch every night for dinner, and so I've grown up with that. But as I became an adult, the biggest thing for me was it cheap? I can make it fresh, but as long as it's cheap, because I make really big bucks as a Presbyterian pastor, so you know I gotta buy the cheapest food. But then as I got pregnant, I started thinking a little bit more about what I was actually putting into my body, because the little girl that I now have didn't have a choice about what I was putting into her body. And there are a lot of restrictions when you're pregnant, and I ate soft cheese, but she's fine. My daughter's fine. I still ate soft cheese. But there's a bunch of restrictions, and that got me thinking more about food. And when I discovered Michael Pollan's book, I admittedly felt that I had a spiritual experience from God reading this book, convicting me about the way that I spent my dollars and the way that I consumed my food. And so I have since changed a lot of the ways that I cook in my home and host in my home and bake in my home, which is huge for me. So that's...
Well, no, wait a minute. What do you mean spiritual experience? Good grief.
I know.
You're a Presbyterian. This is not the holy word of God.
Exactly. It's not. But there was a sense that when God calls us to be stewards of creation, stewards of the animals in our care, the way that the food industry in general is behaving does not fall in line, in my opinion, with those ideas of stewardship. And I felt, again, convicted by the Holy Spirit that, okay, you know, I should try as best as I can to eat, as I call them, a happy cow or a, you know, happy pig. And there's a farm in Eastern Washington that says that their pigs only have one bad day, and that's kind of what I'm looking for when I eat. So
okay. So yeah. Now, Jeff, you told me that the central one bad day, boy, but that is a doozy. it all happens that one day. But that is Calvinistic too, actually. But it's a predestination.
That's
it was
right.
Your day. You couldn't do anything about it.
That's right.
Jeff, you said that the theological backdrop for this book is, would Jesus eat a corn dog?
That's
right. Please help
That's
me understand right.
that. That's right. One of the questions that is kind of hovering around Michael Pollan's book and what I consider to be a food awareness extravaganza for many people, where they've all of a sudden realized, oh, I'm shopping in a supermarket. Oh, this food may not necessarily be good for me. And so people are rushing to farmers markets on the weekends, and people are buying boxes of things from a local, which is great stuff. But the question that I think centers around it, do we become food fascists in reaction? Do we somehow overreact to the way that we do food? Will we sit down at table with someone who feeds us high fructose corn syrup, which is pretty much what you're eating if you read Michael Pollan's book, is everything is pretty much that. And so the question of hospitality for me is hovering around this. And so, yeah, would Jesus eat a corn dog? Yeah, I think he probably would. And I think I've got some backing on this point, that the hospitality question is going to trump many parts of our discussion. And so I think it's vital for us to theologically, to sociologically, to economically question how we eat, why we eat, what we do. Does our economics drive people into poverty? I mean, there's a slavery question we'll look at later in tonight that's behind the food industry. But do we create a space for people to discover their humanity and to discover God, I think, is really what's part of that.
Now, Mark, you're in the hospitality business.
I am.
And so how do you respond to this book in terms of the issues that kind of jump out at you and how it applies in, you're in a business.
Sure.
But it is a hospitality business, but it's about food.
It's about food, and it's very important that we are good stewards of the business and of the way that we're taking care of people. And obviously in my business, that revolves around what we're serving, what we're offering on the menu. So,
Now, for people outside of Seattle listening to the podcast, what is Canlis Restaurant? What are you known for, and what is your commitment to the person who's coming to eat a meal there?
Canlis Restaurant is a three-generation or 60-year-old restaurant. Now, this year, we'll be celebrating our 60th birthday.
Wow.
And, a place that my grandfather started when he passed away. My parents ran it for 30 years. My younger brother and I now run the restaurant. And it has, I think, since its inception, long been where Seattle celebrates its most prized evenings out. And it has represented all the way from the beginning a lot of leadership in fine dining and hospitality, and can continue to do so. I'll be bold enough to say that I'm a staunch believer that we do that. And so what I mean by saying it's important what we put on the menu, I'm in the trust business, essentially, like your standard banker down the street. And the reason that somebody comes to a restaurant is because they trust that they're giving us their time, they're giving us their most treasured memories, right? And so if I put something on the menu, then you're believing that is something that's safe for you to eat, that's something that you would believe in eating ethically, holistically, morally, that it only had one bad day. And
What do you mean something that ethically? What are the ethics to you of the food business?
You know, 3 weeks ago, I was up on a farm that farms salmon. And Canlis actually serves farmed salmon, which in Seattle you would think would be the last thing I would admit in public. But just the opposite, I'm exceptionally proud of the fact that we serve farmed salmon. But there are some significant ethics around the aquaculture right now, and the way that it's done, and the damaging practices that are happening, and the way that salmon are being raised in the ocean, and the negative effect that's happening on our own precious ecosystem here in the Great Northwest. There are ethics behind that. The people that work there, the way that they're treated, the way the salmon is treated, the way that I tell you I'm going to charge you $40 for a piece of fish, but secretly it's been fed with something that you don't believe in and that a pregnant mother doesn't believe in. That's all very important. And I see it as a restaurant's responsibility, especially one at the top of the food chain, if you will, the top of its game, especially one who's a leader in the industry, to pay exceptionally close attention to that, to be a leader through those issues and to be fighting through those issues.
So for people that haven't read Omnivore's Dilemma, tell us what the essential thesis of this book is. I mean, what is there? There's two basic issues that are being raised. One is, what is the food that we eat and how is it being produced? And is it appropriate? So what is the central point that Paulin's trying to get at? And he does it through looking at four different meals. He has a McDonald's meal. He takes you to Whole Foods and does an organic, what they call an industrial organic meal. Then they go to a farm that's grass-fed, everything's... Yep. And then he goes out and finds
forages.
It himself, forages.
Yep. Exactly.
So hunter-gatherer.
The hunter-gatherer. So what is he trying to say about food in America today?
You know, I think ultimately he is trying to lift the veil, as they say in Food Inc., of the food industry and have us think a little bit more about what we eat. And I like how he split it up into these different meals, and he took a meal and followed it to its source. So the fast food meal he's eating in his car, driving at 55 miles an hour, he traced that all the way back to basically the cornfields and commodity corn, and how commodity corn is driving a lot of the food industry today. Corn is the devil is kind of this sort of, theme that you get from these. It's not really, we know that, but about Jeff saying maybe it is. Yeah. And we are overproducing corn, and that corn is now being fed to the animals that we then eat. And the problem being, of course, that these animals were not created by their creator to eat corn. They were created to eat other things like grass and bugs and grubs and all these things. And he talks about the conditions in these places for the animals. He also talks about produce and what is put on our produce. It goes into big organic. So he's trying to help us think a little bit more about, be intentional about what we're eating, how we're spending our food dollars. And a lot of what he says is basically, now that you know, you're either going to turn a blind eye or you're going to change how you eat. And those are sort of the only two options he leaves you with.
Yeah, and I would just add to, that one of the things that Paulin really wants to make sure that you understand as a reader and as a consumer is the illusion of choice. And so he will take you through a meal, and he'll take you through the way food is produced, and he'll basically say you have the illusion of walking through a supermarket and think you're actually choosing a number of different types of food, and you're actually not. That basically we have, four major conglomerates that are producing poultry, and that the feedlots and the way that they create beef. I mean, there's a rather graphic scene in Food Inc. where in the feedlots where they have all these cattle, they're cleaning out the stomach of one of the main stomachs of a cow. It has a hole that's been bored into it with a plastic holder, and they're literally reaching inside of it and pulling gunk out of it. Being just cleaning out like you're cleaning out a carburetor.
Yeah. Well, and I love the director says, does
enjoy
that
your meal,
the
by the way, folks. Eat up.
Yeah. The director does that hurt the cow? And he's like, oh, no, it's fast.
Yeah, it's just fine for the cow. Fast gun. Because basically the way that the industry is to fatten this up as fast as possible, to get it onto your table as fast as possible for the most efficiently and for the most economically salient. So he's questioning those kind of questions.
And we've been trained to think that tastes good.
Yeah,
that is
right.
One of the major issues we'll run into here is that particular cow with a hole in its stomach, 9 out of 10 people here will choose the taste of that cow over one that was grown on Paulifes Farm.
Because we've been trained.
How does it taste? It does taste different.
It absolutely tastes different. You bet. And every year we'll put grass-fed beef on the menu, and people will say they don't like the flavor of the steak. Well, that is the flavor of steak.
That reminds me of like The Matrix.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't remember what steak tastes like because it's virtual steak. Yeah.
I will have to say that we got a ham for Easter, and we have the same guests over every Easter for Easter dinner. And bar none, best ham anyone's consumed in our house. Like, and I didn't tell them, you know, this is a truly happy ham that I got from a farm, and I met the farmer. I didn't say, you know, everyone
until
just
that one
going
bad
back,
day.
Until that one bad day for Easter, and we said a really long grace and did a lot of incense. No,
so
anyhow, but they loved the taste of it.
Of 45,000 items in the supermarket, 25% or more contain corn or corn byproducts. So what? Is the question. I mean, people, it's like, I'm setting this up somewhat adversarial, but the point is he makes it like the industrial complex does not want you to know this. Yeah. And he says things like, besides Stephen King's, few other writers have made a cornfield seem so sinister.
Exactly.
And there's this, you know, there's this idea that corn is bad, but then somebody says, the fact that McDonald's meal is actually 60% carbon molecules derived from corn doesn't tell me much. Mm-hmm. Is a carbon molecule derived from corn any less healthy for me than a carbon molecule derived from wheat or from grass? Mm-hmm. What's the problem with corn?
I don't think it's efficient.
It grows fast. We can feed all these beasts with it. We can eat it.
I don't think Michael Pollan cares if you eat corn, frankly.
Yeah.
I think what he's trying to do is get people to understand what they're eating.
Yes.
And to understand where it came from and to understand how they're eating. The fact is that some people, the way that they eat, when they go to the grocery store, very little of what they purchase has corn in it. And other people, the way that they eat when they go to the grocery store, almost everything does. This is not just about Pollan's well-intentioned and so articulate relationship with the food and where it came from, but the relationship with the people you're eating with and the way that you're eating and the way that you're spending that time. I think that's really what's going on here. And he launches in that first 100 pages of the book or so sort of a missile attack against corn. And it's true. I didn't before I read the book. And I don't think, by and large, our country understands exactly what we're putting into our bodies, nor has it been necessarily advertised to us.
And I think part of it has to do with what corn does as opposed to what corn is. So one of the concerns about corn is that it fixes carbon in a particular way. And what that does is that when you feed this to an animal that's not native to eating it, it does things to its system. So cattle were not created on this earth to eat corn. You know, so different type of grass they're supposed to eat. As a result of them being force-fed corn, literally shoved down their throats, what's happened is their antibiotics is greatly reduced. And so now we have this thing called E. coli. And so what happens is that the cattle are much higher susceptibility to diseases, including diseases that they never would have contracted in the first place by zeroing out their immunity system. And also by fattening them up so fast that their bone structure doesn't have an opportunity to actually hold up the weight. You have cows literally collapsing on their legs, just still being force-fed to the point that we can bring them to slaughter. Same thing with chickens as well. Yeah.
Now, so one of these points is that the government is not protecting us, but is in fact promoting these practices. And he says that the government essentially is subsidizing bad calories. In other words, if you walk in a grocery store, the products that are cheapest are the products that the government is making most available to you, but they're not the ones that are healthiest for you.
That's true. And that, you know, and that's something that's brought up in the film Food Inc. is there's a family who the father has diabetes and he has to spend over $200 on diabetes medicine every month. And so when they go to the supermarket, and they're very low wage earners, when they go to the supermarket and broccoli costs $1.99 a pound, but you know, the chips in aisle 7 cost 99 cents for an entire bag, you know, what are they going to be able, literally able to feed their family? And part of it, he goes into a very long discussion about government subsidies and how that has broken down and that corn farmers used to be under a actually more biblical model in which more corn was stored by the government and they gave farmers loans that the farmers eventually paid off and sort of... you know, industry, as it will, has sort of chipped away at the laws to make it easier for industry to be industry. And unfortunately, farmers are feeling the effect of that as well. And a lot of them are in debt and unable to feed their own families, even though they're growing, you know, all these amounts of
corn. Well, what do you say to people who say, for instance, one guy said that this book is essentially an anti-capitalist manifesto against Cargill, ADM, and Monsanto? That basically it's somebody who's got a beef, a bone.
No pun intended.
Bone to pick.
That's pretty corny.
Corn-fed bone to pick with agricultural industry. There's another guy that in commenting on this book said, "I'm a fifth generation agriculturalist." He said, "Today's U.S. agriculture is nothing short of awesome. Why isn't the omnivore's development dilemma endorsed by any sources with credible expertise in agriculture?" He said, "I'm a dairy farmer. Small-scale farms cannot feed the U.S., mainly because short of forcing people at gunpoint to go back to grandpa's farm, few people want to work on farms." And he says, "I know this because we try to hire people to milk cows." He's basically saying that the industrial system that has grown up around food is delivering the most efficient delivery system of food in history, and we can't go back because Americans don't want to work on the farm. You know, they don't even want to grow vegetables in their own garden.
Not right now, they don't. And nor would I, really. I think that we've taken the farmer and we've turned them into something that's of yesteryear. And I would think that if we were to poll most people out there, we would assume that they're of a lower intellect, that they don't think and read as much, not as educated. I think we've done something to that whole industry that's a tragedy. And in the same way that right now you're seeing chefs become superstars, you're going to see that push down to farmers because that's the next place for it to go. And chefs didn't used to be that. We opened in 1950. There was no superstardom to cooking in the back of the house. Yeah. That was just one step above slavery, just about, unless you were the actual chef. And even he, it was considered revolutionary that we opened the kitchen to the dining room, because why would you want the chef to be seen by the guests? That was 1950 in our own country. And nowadays they have their own channels on television. So I think what you're going to find is as those folks point to the farmers, you're going to see more attention put on sort of the glamour and the sex appeal, if you will. I mean, shoot, now there's a television show on butchers. And even when this was written in 2006, Pollan was saying, well, where can you find a butcher? And now we can find them on television. So there is a shift happening, but I think that's going to be slow in coming.
Well, and it's also, I think, the shift, you know, and he makes the point as well that the market is going to drive it. I mean, if people want grass-fed, grass-finished animals, they're going to
vote with their dollars. But he's saying he puts on his menu and they don't like the taste of it.
I put it on my menu and it sells out. So I have a farm that just grows grass-fed beef only for canless. And it's all that farm can do to keep me going in my restaurant for 4 weeks.
But you say that some people say they don't like the taste of it initially, or...?
And a lot of people don't understand the taste of it. But with a little bit of encouragement, they very quickly
now,
come
around. Now,
why
is that important to you, personally?
Other than the fact that they walk around away and say that steak wasn't worth it and they never come back, that's an issue to me. Again, my job is to protect the 3 hours that they give me, to protect their daughter's only 16th birthday or that one time their grandmother's in town before she dies of cancer. That's my job.
So is there an educational component to this for you as a restaurateur?
It's the educational component. It takes a backseat to everything else, but absolutely there is. But that rarely happens at the table. Rarely. It's not the place for it. It's not the right time.
But there are people that want it.
Absolutely. I sell straight through that entire farm's allotment. She slaughters twice. I'm talking about Gleason Ranch in southern Washington here. She slaughters twice a year, and that's all Tracy Baker can afford to give me.
Now, what's interesting is that they point out in the book and in Food Inc. that we have a sentimental attachment to the farm. Like, all of the butter shows a little farm, and all of, they want us to think that all of these products are grown on these little mom-and-pop farms. So there is somehow within the human a desire that it be a human transaction with people that do care about what they're doing. So is that how do we crank that into the equation, the camouflaging of kind of industry versus an actual farm? Like, you're talking about, you know, the farmer that grows this, you know, grass-fed beef.
Sure, but my job is to buy $1 million of food a year. And most people don't do that. And most people go to the grocery store, and that's as deep as they can get.
Wow, I'm never going to complain about my family food budget again. $1 million a year.
It's a lot of food, and that number will go up. And that's not necessarily a matter of how many people come into the restaurant. That's just the price of food these days. But I think that what we're doing in the book, in fact, both the book and the movie, mention the idea of putting glass walls around a meat packing, a meat processing facility. That's not likely to happen, I would imagine. But the idea of consumer education pushing for more clarity and more transparency, I think, has taken root. Whether or not there's heavy-hitting agricultural experts supporting the book or not, there's a large enough movement in the country, and people are wise enough to recognize a little piece of truth when they hear it, and I think that's what's happening.
What's the piece of truth that you think they're hearing?
Pay attention to what you eat. It matters, probably more than you know, and the answer may be a little bit scarier than you think. I think that's what people are truly resonating with. Mm. This idea that it's true that when you taste a burger from a fast food company, you're not really tasting like grilled beef and cheese made from the things that cheese are supposed to be made from, would be principally milk. and bread, you know, you're tasting sort of what Pollan so beautifully described as sort of like the idea of a hamburger, but you're not actually getting into the flavors of it. And when you go through and taste through, you can tell looking at the raw product, the real from the processed or the industrial.
So now, Jeff, you're a theologian. and have I mentioned a tenured professional?
Yeah. We've heard that.
So, so in what sense is there a theological issue at stake here?
Well,
when you read this as a theologian, what's going on in your kind of theological brain?
Well, it's interesting that the story of, you know, particularly from Christianity and even from the Abrahamic religions, I mean, you know, the beginning of humanity begins with a diet plan.
Yeah.
You know, you shall not touch that tree. kind of begins.
But notice it wasn't a corn dog.
Well,
that Jesus would eat
later.
A corn dog.
Yeah. You know, you're not going to win on that because I'm going to win on the corn dog argument.
Okay.
I have to because I love corn dogs. Anyway, so I'm biased and not objective. But you know, the entire history of religions, major world religions, are deeply enmeshed in food, and part of it is because that is, in a sense, of who we are.
Yeah.
So to extricate the question of food from what we believe is impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, every world religion deals with food, whether it is leaving food, you know, as a preparation for a puja in Hinduism, whether it is the sacramental meal of bread and wine that is cornerstone of Christianity, you know, whether it is a Seder meal in Judaism. I mean, the preparation of table fellowship, of hospitality, is key to religion. It's absolutely key to who we are. And so theologically, I think when you go back to Genesis and then, you know, fast forward all the way through the canonical scriptures and whatnot, food is very much a part of it. The thing we've lost, or the inability to now to really deal with, is the question of what food to eat. And what's happened, and this really begins in 70 AD in Judaism and in the burgeoning of Christianity with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. When that destruction of the temple happened, all of a sudden now we didn't know where sacred and profane were to be happening. Anything inside a temple is pure. Everything outside the temple is profane. Right? So if you made it through all the temple courts and everything and you got inside the temple, you're pure and you can eat it, right? But what if the temple isn't there anymore to tell you what's pure and what's defiled anymore? Now, what do you do? Well, now all of a sudden people start scrolling back and start saying, well, then the object in and of itself has to be either pure or profane, right? So now it can never be sanctified, right? So that meat that you're eating has to always and for all time be wrong. This always and for all time has to be right. There is no possibility of redemption anymore. And when you get to Jesus' ministry, he turns the tables literally and figuratively on that question in the midst of the temples and say, you're asking the wrong question. You know, is that everything can be redeemed. Everything was created by God. The question is how we process it. And so, I mean, again, I can go on and on and on this topic, but I think the question of clean and dirty is very much a part of this question. I think it is, what does it mean to be at fellowship? Because much of the Bible is dealing with the question of, are you creating hospitality or hostility towards the stranger? And so what happens here at the table is the one main place where this happens. Jesus is inviting himself to dinner all the time. You know, so meals are big.
Well, this is Nick Staub. You're listening to the Kinley's Muse, where we all practice the Miss Piggy diet. Don't eat more than you can lift. We're going to be right back with more right after this. Don't go away.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dick Staub back with you with the Dancing Bear, Jeff Cuse. Tenured Dancing Bear on the Kindling's Muse Show. And, you know, one of the interesting, there's a lot of places we can go with this show, and I apologize that it's such a massive subject, but you got to read the book and see the movie and get in some good conversations. We haven't talked about oil. And if you look at the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, it is directly related to this subject because almost everything we eat uses enormous amounts of fossil fuels to get it to our tables. According to this book, oil products are part of the fertilizers that feed plants, the pesticides that keep insects away from them, fuels used by trains and trucks that transport them across the country, the packaging in which they're wrapped. We are addicted to oil, and we really like to eat, says this book. So those of us, I find it really interesting that all these people carrying the signs and protesting BP on the shores all drove to get there. And, you know, you've got this just about everything we talk about tonight is a situation where we're caught in a kind of a paradoxical dilemma, which is why this is called the Omnivore's Dilemma, because we do like to eat. We like it to be convenient. We like it to be cheap. We like it to be fast. But the very delivery system that is providing that luxury is costly environmentally and health-wise. You know, one of the things that this book is trying to point out is, well, one of the chapters is called The Republic of Fat. Mm-hmm. And it's talking about the fact that we essentially have created a diet that is not that healthy and that is heavy in fats. Another unintended pun. I found one of the fascinating things about this book was in the film particularly, the argument that America was particularly vulnerable to this movement because we have no national diet. That we came here from many different countries, and we have this hodgepodge of quasi-Thai, quasi-Mexican, quasi-Irish, quasi-French. But if you look at a lot of other cultures, like the French take their food very seriously. They have a deep connection to their food. Or most other countries of the world, really, underdeveloped countries, if you go to those countries, you'll find that people are very connected to the food sources and to how they eat. They're buying their produce fresh every day. They're going to the market and buying what they're going to eat that day. So America has had this vulnerability, and we've had this, if there's one thing that has characterized America, it's been pragmatism and scalability. The idea that we could do things on a bigger scale to reduce cost. And so we've developed this, what one person says is an amazing system, but Paula is trying to point out that it's a system that has its downside, and its downside relates to our health, what it's doing to the farmers, what it's doing to the family farm, and so forth. Before we go further, I do want to kind of get into what this all means for us. It's one of those subjects where Kathy will tell you, by the way, my wife is here tonight, the lovely Yay. Kathy. It's the first time in years she's come to one of the shows. She's really afraid of what I'm going to say, which is why she handily provided me with some tape tonight. But I used to do, when I did my national show, I would do a lot of subjects like this, and I'd come home and I'd tell Kathy, we've got to change, and I'd want to throw everything out of our kitchen, and I'd want to do everything different, whatever subject it was that day, whether it's raising children or communicating about and because there's hundreds of these books out there, and just about everything we're doing in American life, we're told, is wrong. You shouldn't be doing it that way. Now, this is a huge subject. Because if you read this book and you feel like, well, good grief, this woman thinks it came from the Holy Spirit of the Lord.
Not the whole thing.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, she feels spiritual conviction about this. So what? What do we do about this? So we know that it's, you know, dependent on the oil industry and that it's big, gigantic industrial complexes and that, you know, it's more than an animal having one bad day. It's having an entire bad life. What do we do differently?
Well, it's funny, you talked at the beginning about how, you know, well, we like cheap food, we like this, we like that. And I'm raising a 2-year-old, and just because she likes it doesn't mean she gets it. So that's kind of, you know, my attitude about some of these things. Just because that's what we want or that's what we like doesn't mean necessarily mean that that's healthy for us or good for us or a good choice for us on many different levels. Good choices for the planet, good choices for our own health, and things like that. And so I think as you read this book and investigate this more, you're going to make more decisions about what you're doing in your own home. And we've made those decisions. I was joking at the break about trying to go without going seasonal in the winter, especially around produce and fruit. And we were, you know, I am so sick of bananas because there is nothing. I mean, that was the one thing. We'll have bananas. But there's no other fruit that's seasonal and local in Seattle in the winter. I think maybe pears, but I'm not the biggest pear. And bananas, see, our bananas are not, but it was our one sort of, you know, caveat, we can eat bananas. But it's hard to do, I guess is what I'm saying. But as you investigate it, there are places that you can go and you can, at farmers market, meet farmers. You get produce from local farmers, meat from local farmers.
Well, and so it's more expensive.
It's more
right?
expensive.
Right? I mean, if you want to, and what about the Whole Foods part of this? Because there's a whole, you know, chapter that's devoted to, we've gotten very excited about organic and this is the good alternative, but it in fact is still a very petroleum-based system, this corn-based system, it's still... So what are our real alternatives? Because that's what he's exploring. He's saying, I can go out and forage. Not. He goes to this guy that raises all of his food, you know, grass-fed, and the one bad day for the chicken is done humanely. They show us the very, very delicate slice across the neck. But it's still a very, very bad day for that chicken. And so what are we supposed to do with all of this?
Let me just sum that up for you.
Thank you, Mark. Please bail us out here, brother.
America is a two-year-old that very rarely gets told it can't have what it wants. And
Do you have a two-year-old?
I have a two-year-old. I just spent 8 hours on an airplane with her.
Woohoo!
And my four-year-old.
I could ask you a really hard question. What did you feed them to keep them satisfied on this flight?
Knowing that I was coming
now,
to the
dear,
show.
This is some grass-fed beef.
I'm trying to finish the book.
Okay.
And they literally come by with what are the curly corn ones?
Oh, Fritos.
Fritos.
Yeah.
A cheeseburger, and the carrots, the very shaved ones that Pollen talks about. And so I'm sitting, my wife actually deserves all the credit for the flight. She was with the two kids behind. I'm in front in the middle. And so I hold up the cheeseburger and the book. And I said, what am I supposed to do?
It's called the omnivore's dilemma.
It's called the dad on an airplane dilemma. I don't know what she fed them. I know they didn't eat the cheeseburger out of recent moral conviction. But I think that as a country, it's pretty rare when we, when we're properly constrained or disciplined in that way. And flying over the spill a few hours ago, it was a poignant reminder of just how fragile we are a little bit as a country. And I think that this is my roundabout way of saying, what are we to do? We're not necessarily to fix anything. I think that we have a responsibility ourselves to wrestle with it. And that in and of itself would be an enormous accomplishment if everybody at least wrestled with it. They don't have to agree with it. They don't have to run away from it. They don't have to preach it from some sort of organic pulpit or something. But I think to sort of to take it in and to stick it in your gullet, if you will, and to chew on it for a while, I think would be a wholesome endeavor for the country to go through, whether it's the oil issue or whether it's the organic movement, which is maybe not as happy as we'd all like it to be. It's not a simple issue. How much time do we have? Like 20 minutes?
What do you say, Jenny?
Well, I think he's completely right that I think educating yourself is the first thing that you do. I find it so interesting how much research and process we do in buying a cell phone, you know, and some of these people, these iPhones, you know, $500 phone or whatever. And I, you know, I'm not commenting on your spending habits, but that's if you wanted to buy a whole cow from Eastern Washington, that's what it costs, $500. So you know, there are different choices that you can make, but to wrestle
have
with it and really actually think, we're actually buying half a cow because we can't.
You are,
yeah.
What's happened to the other half?
It's going to my brother.
It's delaying the very
exactly.
Bad day.
It's going to hang out in my backyard.
They grow half cows on.
My sister-in-law's parents are cattle ranchers, and they do the whole grass-fed, grass-finished
really?
Thing. And we're there. It's coming from Montana,
so
baby.
It's being butchered and
yeah, coming.
And then
to
you're
us.
Putting in a freezer and
yeah. And we're about to buy a quarter of a pig from this different ranch that I got the Easter ham from. But you know, here's the problem. It took a ton of my time to research that. Eatwild.com is a really great resource to look at places that are local to you that the farmers practice these things. But it takes a lot of thinking and people don't want to do that. You don't. But it's cheap. It's easy. Let
There's
me just pick it up.
And yeah.
But yet again, you know, how much time do you spend thinking about the car you're going to buy
or
all
these
other
television.
Things?
Like, yeah. I mean, you know, or paying for your I have an iPhone, paying for it monthly. They're very expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, Pollan makes a good point of just the percentage of the income that the country used to spend on food compared to what it is now. It's much smaller now. And people are not willing to pay for it. And that's part of the problem. The other problem is a lot of the country can't. And yes. I mean, there's this sort of mythology about...
It's a justice issue. Yeah.
It's absolutely a justice issue. You can't tell a single mother in the Central District that she's going to go buy a $20 chicken.
Totally.
You're crazy.
Yeah.
Right? And so there are larger issues at hand going on. And
so how does that crank into the ethical equation? Because it sounds like the industrial complex is providing an efficiency that helps the poor.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, what... Everybody has a fixed amount of money that they have in their pocket, right?
And we do.
So, yeah. Well, so some do, but generally you have a certain amount of money, and then you have to decide where do these pieces of pie go? Am I going to spend it on housing? Am I going to spend it on leisure? Am I going to spend it on food?
Right? Or a half a cow.
Or a half a cow, right? And so you're going to bracket these out. One of the biggest critiques about Michael Pollan and the whole locavore movement is that it's a middle class anxiety issue. Right, that this is an issue that can be dealt with, agonized about, and solved if you're at a certain economic bracket. If you are a hourly wage earner who has three kids at home, you're a single parent, you're basically barely making it by, you're trying to do whatever you can to get by, you can't buy food boxes. You don't have the time or the energy to solve that problem. And so part of the justice question around food has to do with the responsibility of how do we steward the resources that we have to those who don't have. Bringing Jesus into the question, right? Okay, so how did Jesus solve the omnivore's dilemma? You know, I mean, in Matthew 6, he says, consider the lilies of the field. And he spends this whole discourse on look around you, look at the birds of the air, look at the lilies of the field. You know, they don't need anything, and God provides for them. You know, so you who have a lot, stop being anxious. You know, stop your anxiety, stop pursuing other things, consider what is before you, and will you accept it? And then you can give it away to other people. So it becomes a stewardship issue of resources. And this is what table fellowship is about, is if you have a lot, give it away. If you don't have, be welcome at the table without guilt about coming to the table. Basic pragmatic things that I think that he raises is, do we actually know where food comes from and what it actually takes to produce food? I would love for every church in America to jackhammer at least one parking spot, build a small pea patch in that parking spot in your parking lot, and grow food. So everybody who comes into your church sees peas coming up.
The late sees first, lettuce. The church doesn't get to park.
You don't
get a parking spot.
Yeah. I mean, you tell her to go
you
away.
You got to weed
the garden. But seriously, I mean, the cycle of watching something grow forces us to move out of our time into God's time. In our little backyard, and we have a very small backyard, our girls...
I'm just picturing the Crystal Cathedral with, like, a pea vine growing up the entire...
Awesome, that'd be great.
A testimony to the Lord, 35-story beanstalk.
And what that does, I mean, just in a very simple move, and a very pragmatic move, is you get to watch and set your clock against the process of something else other than yourself. So now I have to wait. I have to care for something. And when it comes to me and put on my table, I savor it. My
okay, now, but so now, are we getting down to there's a theology of being human that has to do with our relationship with food?
Absolutely.
Like
Lucy
Shaw gave this amazing presentation a few years ago. I'll never forget it. And by the way, she's at Kindlings Fest this summer.
Shameless plug.
She talked about all of the metaphors in the New Testament are organic. They're agricultural metaphors. They're not organizational. They're not, she said, you know, the American model is we produce hot dogs, and you push all this stuff in the front end, and all the hot dogs come out. They're exactly the same shape, size. It's a production model, whereas the metaphor in the New Testament was all organic. It grew at different rates. It grew differently. It came out different. Every piece of fruit is different, and there was something that she feels it was not just rooted in first century because it was an agricultural, but it actually has to do with the nature of being human, that we are more an organic than a production kind of creation.
There was, I mean, when you go back to the garden, right, Genesis 1, Genesis 2, you know, human beings are given three basic jobs as far as this will help you understand who you are, right? Number one, acknowledge God as being God, right? So worship, right? Do that. Second, think about things. So name things, right? Categorize things, right? That's what human beings do, right? I mean, we actually can think about why we're here and where we've been, and we can have memory and all these kind of things. And third, care for the garden, right? So, which means participate in the soil of things in a particular way that means you set your clock and your dependence on something that is not you, right? So wait to see if that tree is going to produce a fruit or not. You know, and what that's going to mean is, as opposed to the way we live our lives now, which is filled with anxiety and dependency and urgency and, you know, the microwave, you know, oven of, you know, ding is defines everything. You know, now it's this when it comes, we celebrate it.
Yeah.
I mean, what would it mean for every family to have at least one thing as part of their meal structure as something they grew?
You know, I'm going to ask you an embarrassing question.
Yep.
You want me to lose a parking space at church?
Absolutely.
Probably the senior pastor's parking place is would be the nice thing.
I don't want
to
be sued for libel, but
okay,
I'd go there.
Do you have a garden?
Yes, we do.
You do?
Yeah, my wife's in the background. Do we have a garden?
Whoa!
Testimony.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, it's very small, but you know what we're
one
growing
parking
lettuce,
place.
Radishes. When my here's tragedy. My wife working as an art docent in an elementary school brought as one of their art projects some radishes that we grew and put them before the kids and say, you know, draw a picture with this. Didn't know what they were. Didn't know what they were. They'd never seen them before.
Well, if you had had a Hostess Twinkie tree,
yeah,
then they would have known.
But the thing is, food in and of itself, as grown, is a beautiful thing. So there's an aesthetic to food, and we wonder at it when we see it, as opposed to process.
Mm-hmm. I've got to get a shout out though to First Presbyterian Church in Bellevue. They host a farmer's market in Bellevue in their parking lot. So their entire parking lot is a farmer's market.
Wow, there you go.
For one day.
But
get out of there by Sunday because we got to move the cars,
yeah,
baby.
Yeah, true.
Okay. Well, we're going to get to our questions from the audience, the live audience, the lively audience, the pesky audience with all sorts of questions. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to Kindlings News at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. We'll be right back. Thanks for joining us tonight. You're listening to Kindlings Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. It is June 2010, and this is the final show for the summer. We'll be back in September, cranking it up again. And, of course, we also do a show starting in September at the University of Washington at the Burke Museum Cafe. And stay tuned for other shows at Sundance Film Festival and elsewhere this next year. And let's get out into the highways and byways and see if I can find my way to some of the tables here where we have some questions. And we're going to get started with Griggs. What's your question this evening?
Dick, I said here, isn't the sustainable cities movement, the backyard chicken movement in Michelle Obama's garden, indication of the back to the earth movement?
Yeah, I mean,
oh,
I
what
would
a surprise
so
that Jenny would pick that one up.
Yeah, exactly.
The one that has a little baby outfit that says Obama. What is it? Kids for Obama?
Babies. It says babies.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Yeah, I'm revealing my political. It's pink. It's
Were
got
you
Barack
set
on the
up
front.
In the audience tonight by the Obama administration?
No,
to
No. No, I think that it, again, as Mark was pointing out, that it is starting to catch in popular culture, these sorts of ideas about food, and I think as more of it catches in popular culture, that's going to drive the market, and eventually, you know, as things go, people will put their purchasing power behind that. A lot of it has to do with education. I actually saw on C-SPAN, Michelle had a question and answer day.
Are you
when
on
it was
a first name basis? Is this Michelle?
No. I'm sorry, the first lady, I should
okay.
say.
It's like, oh, wow.
She was having a one-on-one with kids for Bring Your Kids to Work Day, and they got a lot of questions about food and how they grow it, and she's very involved in kids and eating and a lot of poor kids and she's one of her campaigns is about the diabetes happening in children and so anyhow as people like that are joining this movement if you want to call it that I think there's going to be more press and more people are going to think about what they eat and where they get it and all those things.
The downside, I mean, it's exciting to think about people thinking about where food comes from. Right, and going through the process of caring for chickens in your backyard and growing, you know, some of your own things. But the problem is that if it's just to alleviate guilt, or if it becomes kind of a, you know, I'm this middle class person, I'm growing my own food, then it becomes selfish. You know, the question is hospitality. Are you growing it then to create a space for people at your table to experience this is what a real head of lettuce is like? That's the next step. And I think what Michelle Obama is doing, what other people are trying to do, is trying to create community gardens that actually brings people together around the process of growing. That's exciting. If it's just you trying to say, okay, look at me, I've got stuff I grew in my own garden, then that becomes more about food fascism than it does about
Sharing earlier that on Orcas Island we have the food bank, and we've gotten different farmers in cooperation to start delivering fresh produce at the food bank, yeah. which is really rare, it turns out, in food banks. We happen to have a grocery store manager who's the head of the food bank now, who's really got a relationship with all the farmers on the island and all the growers, and there's a lot of enthusiasm around it. It's really exciting to see people walking out with bags of fresh vegetables where that didn't used to be a feature. Don, what's your question?
Yes, it seems like a lot of these problems have to do with meat and meat in the diet. How much meat do we actually need to get by? To be healthy.
Ooh. Wow. Well, we're asking a theologian, you understand.
Jeff, you're all over that one.
Yeah, I'm on that. You know, it depends on who you talk to. You know, I mean, there is a Christian vegan movement that basically believes that, you know, meat is antithetical to what it means to follow God. I mean, you actually even have popular
flies artists. In the face of the famous corn dog theology.
I didn't say I signed up for this. I just said I'm just giving an objective, so-called objective opinion. You know, and you have even popular artists like Moby, who in his CD Play, which got, you know, massive multi-million number of sales on that, he dedicated all of his liner notes to veganism and used, you know, started quoting Augustine and all these things about the nature of veganism. I think that the question around meat, you know, is it's one of the cornerstones of a meal for many Americans. It's become a traditional part of how we understand celebrations. When I used to work at Providence Medical Center, and we'd have these huge fundraising banquets, we'd always have options of fish or steak, you know, as the option for people when they come. You get two choices when you come to these big banquets. And 9 times out of 10, people would choose the steak option for big celebrations. And it always astounded me, because most of these people who would come, you'd think that would be much, you know, well, I just want to eat fish, I want to eat, you know, eat vegetables. But for celebrations, meat is still the marker of this is a big deal. You know, Thanksgiving has never really the tofu turkey hasn't really taken off.
Mercifully.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, meat's not going away.
Yeah, yeah.
It's here to stay, as well it should be. I think that less meat than probably y'all think is appropriate. There's a lot of spectacular food out there that has nothing to do with killing an animal. Though I don't have any problems with killing an animal, I sort of think that that's the way things have been set up here on Earth. So I think that in this culture we have a... Jeff's right. We celebrate typically with meat, whether that's a big ham or a turkey or a roast or something like that. But generally, there's a little bit of a laziness going on with the way that we cook and the way that we think about food. And if we were to a little more creativity and resourcefulness, I think you'd find that meat doesn't have to be necessarily the center stage, nor does it need to be in the center of the plate either. It could be an accompaniment to something else.
What's your question, Jeff?
Will Canlis restaurants buy seafood and fish from the Gulf of Mexico, knowing that thousands and thousands are getting out of work, and also knowing that, quote, nobody knows what danger has been done to that marine life and won't know probably until people get in their research hit? Will you buy from the Gulf?
This is from a reporter from the National Enquirer checking in with Mark Canlis tonight.
Well, it's a great question, and certainly the onus is on us to figure out a good answer for you. I don't know if I have one yet. I don't know if enough time has passed for us to figure out specifically if it's the responsible thing to buy shrimp. Specifically, is probably the biggest thing, biggest issue right now to the Gulf. Will we support them if we can? Absolutely. I've got roots in the South, and so it's a place that's near and dear to my heart. My grandfather just passed away. He lived in Pensacola his entire life, as did his father and his grandfather. We're deeply tied to that region, and that's where I just came back from. The restaurant and the people will support it in every way that we can. I don't know specifically if that means that we're going to ad nauseum buy fish from that region. Specifically, I don't know if it's my responsibility in Seattle to be buying fish from the South. There's an issue of freshness. There's an issue, of course, of oil. But when we talk about shrimp, when the spot prawns go away here in Puget Sound, it's a very short season. You know, where am I going to get prawns from? So it's an important issue and one that we're paying close
attention
to.
Don't we have an advantage in the Northwest over a lot of other regions in the country because of the bounty that we have?
Nothing touches the Northwest. Yeah. I can't think of a region in our country, at least, not off the top of my head, that has anything near what we do, and specifically because of our relationship to Alaska. Yeah.
Kathy and I were invited to a Thanksgiving dinner a few years ago on orcas, and the guy that certifies all the divers on the islands does it the day after Thanksgiving, and they all dive and bring back stuff from the waters around Orcas Island, and you're having this amazing all seafood, all fresh, all brought in that day, and it's like you're just never going to experience this anywhere else.
You can't ask for a wealthier diversity of agriculture, aquaculture. We have a desert on the other side of the mountains that produces fantastic beef and wine and all of our fruit. We've got all of the lush, fertile land. We've got the oceans.
Yeah.
Both what happens in our cold Puget Sound and on the outside, and then all the way up to Alaska. It's, from my standpoint, you couldn't be in a better place.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, what's your question?
Well, so, Jenny, in listening to you before about buying beef, we did the same sort of thing where my brother-in-law grew beef, and we've switched because we got tired of buying half a beef and feeling obligated to use it while we sat and watched it, you know, seemingly wither away and change molecularly in the freezer and all that. So, you know, what we've tended to do now is buy a little bit now and again from our local organic butcher down the street, which we are fortunate to have, and buy some of the everyday stuff at Costco. But
so I'm wait, Costco, you dropped off on the last part of that sentence. That was.
Hey, but it's out there now. It's out there.
I use the word Costco. I'm sorry. So anyway, I'm just wondering.
That will be edited off the show.
Hey, it's a local company. It's local. All right.
That's right. So I'm wondering what you and Mark think about that from a quality and ethical point of view.
Love their bratwurst, $1.50 hot dog and bratwurst.
Yeah, there you go. Corn dogs, Jeff. I'm sure. There are just. to let you know, there's a little plug for one of the farms that we get our meat from, Crown S Ranch. S is in Seattle, over in Eastern Washington. Anyhow, you're able to buy an eighth of a cow, or a much smaller amount. I cook a lot, like I said. Everything, almost 98% of what comes out of my house is made fresh and from scratch. So we'll go through this cow. Ground beef that sat in the freezer for a year and a half is not going to be...
Probably the wrong move.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with supporting a butcher, AJ Meats, up here on Queen Anne. Has been there for over 50 years. They do a great job, and there are a number of butchers up and down the Puget Sound area that do a fantastic job. So I don't think there's ethically it's better one way or the other. I think as long as you're paying attention to where the beef came from, and to the company that's processing it for you. That has just recently changed here in Washington State. The USDA has recently allowed a mobile slaughter unit, which is a very big deal for us and something we can all be quite proud of, but allows very small farmers to not process their cattle and in the big system, where essentially they get lost. So it's kind of a cool thing that's happening down south. But
that's really great.
And there are
a couple artisan butcher shops that have popped up around Seattle as well. One in West Seattle called The Swinery in particular has an exciting... What? I didn't make up the name.
I just keep thinking Pigs in Space from Muppets.
I know.
It's a tough name.
Prosciutto in Space. Yeah, yeah. Anyhow, Gabriel's, they have fantastic cured meats and
but
so
not
salamis.
Kosher.
Like, you don't have to give up pepperoni. You know, all these
to be honest, we haven't even talked about what cuts of beef you're eating.
Yeah.
But feel free to stray from the New York and your filet because, that's about 8% of the cow, and the rest of it's got to get eaten too. And so the way that you buy meat in either a supermarket or at a butcher or at a local shop is very important. All those cuts have to be consumed. And typically we go in and we go for the juicy things that are easy to prepare and easy to think about. But the whole animal can be used in an incredible and exceptionally tasty
way. All right. Kyle, your question.
Well, it's more of a comment. I've just been unemployed for the past year, and I just finished building a vegetable garden in my parents' front yard of 6 raised beds. My wife and I moved in when I lost my job. I am patiently waiting for a job and my potatoes. I agree with the idea of God's timing and have learned that there is nothing I can do to make my peas grow faster or make a job come to me sooner than it is supposed to.
Yeah. Amen.
May God bring you a job before the potatoes come.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Here you go, David.
Hello. So there's been some talk about looking at the working class and talking about kind of the economic and pragmatic issues dealing with that. So my question has to do with how do we bring a diversity of food choice to the working class without just patronizing them or focusing on like handouts and stuff like that. So
exactly what a lot of people want to do is dump food into the areas of our city that are poor, which is insulting, honestly. And what we're working with, there's a company called a non-for-profit called Clean Greens, and I have a world of respect for them. They are an essentially a community supported agricultural, and what they're doing is as I buy a box of produce that comes to my door, they match it and send one into the central district. But what they're doing is working with the families, and they will not grow faster than they can relate, essentially, because what they know is what Jeff you were speaking to earlier, is that this is an issue of relating to one another, to people, and what they're doing is working with the people and changing habits and the character issues around the way that you eat and teaching these ideas that there are other options other than fast food. There's the equal sin would be to dive into this book and consider it the only way to eat. And you mentioned that as well. To the degree that it destroys hospitality, I think you've made a gross and terrible and inhumane error. And so what they're trying to do is go in and to say, look, let's work with these people. They have a farmer's market. They do dinners. They actually do cooking classes. And then they support that with CSA that's donated essentially from various folks around the city. I think that's a pretty sustainable model. I've never seen another one like it. And Canlis has been working hard to try to support them because I'm just incredibly impressed with them. Apart from that, I don't have many answers for you, and I don't think others do either. It seems to be the very slow and messy business of dealing with people. And we're all messy, and we're all slow. And there's no quick fix to that. It's an understanding and a vulnerability that comes with time, and I don't think that you can just slap a Band-Aid on it and call it and feel good about it when you go to sleep. It's not going to happen.
Lyle, what's your question?
Milk comes in a carton. Meat comes on a tray.
Mr. Rogers has joined us tonight.
Exactly.
Vegetables are found in a automatically sprayed region of a grocery store.
My kids love that, man.
I guess what I'm addressing is the idea that we're sort of disconnected from where our food has come from. When I was a kid, I was sent out, mom set out a kettle, I'm a farm kid, a kettle of scalding water and said, I need two chickens for lunch. Here's the axe. And I had to do that, and it's kind of disturbing, actually.
How many of you have killed a chicken? I want to see a show of hands right now. How many of you have killed an animal? Raise your hand if you've killed an animal. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Exactly.
I'm not talking about in your car. That doesn't count.
Kill.
But roadkill can be used in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. We're going to open the confessional later.
It's category number two.
I mean, this is an incredible point. I recently invited 10 of what I think are the best chefs in Seattle to dinner at the restaurant for a community dinner. We do this every year. And last year we sent an email, which we considered pretty weak sauce of us and not very creative. This year I sent a courier squab. I wanted to send a courier pigeon, but there's no service in Seattle that does courier pigeons. And courier pigeons actually return. They don't go out, I learned. And so we sent a squab, actually, in a cage. A squab, of course, is a pigeon, more or less, a baby pigeon, with a note attached to its foot that said, come to dinner and bring a story about your squab and a good bottle of wine, and let's talk about sustainability. 10 chefs all around one dinner table. How many of them do you think had a hard time killing the bird? 4 out of 10. One of them, in an hour, sent me a picture of the bird, plucked, cleaned, dressed, seasoned, and ready to go in the oven. She in her restaurants on 45th, knew exactly what she was doing. Many had a hard time. So it's not just that we're disconnected as normal people, but globally, even a lot of the people in the industry are disconnected. And that's, I don't think it's an overstatement to say it's a little scary.
Yeah.
And Michael Pollan actually brings that point up, and he says that, you know, he tries to balance out the whole glass, when you have glass walls around slaughterhouses, and says that, yeah, there is death and life are part of what we do. and this is, again, you know, putting on the theologian's hat. I mean, there is a time to reap, and there is a time to sow, and there is a time for death, and there's a time for life. And the more that we participate in that, actually we can participate with more wholesomeness. I mean,
I love his hunting scene.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
He wants to stare at the pig in the eye, sort of. He wants to sort of look at it and deal with it himself. And he goes hunting. If you haven't read the book, it's a great. And I hunt from time to time, and he does an incredible job for a non-hunter of describing
that
tension. And it is a tension.
Yeah,
should be.
All right, Mike, what's your question?
Well, you know, compulsively we eat. We probably, most of us eat too much. So my question, how does sin factor into the equation?
Well,
gluttony?
You know,
are you asking the gluttony question?
I think you know, absolutely. I mean, gluttony is, you know, one of the vices that is certainly outlined, and certainly, you know, this is something dealt with. And again, all major religions. I mean, Christianity is the only one that's got the corner of the market on calling people to task on gluttony. But I think certainly what we're looking at, particularly in American society, is a question of overeating, because we don't actually know what it is to stop eating. Our identity is defined by consumption, not by production now. We've moved as a society that knows who my sense of power and my individuality is because I can purchase this thing and I can consume it, as opposed to producing it and taking pride in the product that I do, which is part of the debt crisis. If I buy more, I must be still alive. So what we need to do is kind of move from consumption to production, which is why, again, I pushed on this idea. If you just participate in growing something, you know, that then you can see the worth in something and participate in it in a different way. And I think literally that hunger, you know, to consume something, you know, that creates that gluttonous push is because we're desperately trying to grab on something for meaning. And actually, another book that I think that Michael Pollan should have referenced in his book is one called Much Depends on Dinner by Margaret Visser, who's a Canadian author. And she does the exact same thing, but much earlier than Michael Pollan, takes, you know, this meal apart and works through it. And one of the things she talks about is boredom, is that people eat out of boredom as opposed to purpose. And that's what Americans have lost, is the ability to have a purposeful meal. And it's what's amazing in restaurants, and this is what's interesting, I don't know if Candless has experienced, but more and more people are eating alone. and when you eat with people, you spend time talking more and kind of conversing more, and so you're not consuming as
it
much.
It was designed as a community thing.
It's a community thing.
It's sad, but my business is a good one to be in right now, because if I were to poll the country, most of you wouldn't know how to cook. Very few of you would eat together as a family. And those that did would have the TV on, essentially. The vast majority of you would have the TV on. And the conversation would be as dead as the ground in those CAFOs that the cattle are getting fed corn on. I mean, it would just be sad. And so the way that we eat
has changed. He has seen inside your home.
Yes, yes.
I'm not saying that about the 60 of you. Or maybe I am.
A deadly, guilty Paul fell over the ground.
I'm saying that about the 60 of us as a country. And I don't think that we are very good at anymore being together. And being together is as much an ingredient at dinner as is what you're eating. And if you miss that, you've missed dinner altogether. And in my business, I get to profit off of people that don't know how to do that anymore. And so they come to do that with us. And it's our role to help that happen.
Well, and he speaks in the book about people considering a sit-down meal with their family, mom going in and making a salad and eating at the dinner table, and teenage daughter microwaving something and sitting on the couch and eating it maybe 5 minutes after. Like, people surveyed consider that a sit-down meal with their family.
Well, here's data for you. If you want to graduate a National Merit Scholar from your home, if you want to grow up a kid who's going to go off to college and all that, one of the national indicators, searchinstitute.org, okay, the Search Institute has done data for 40 developmental assets. One of the key assets to success of keeping kids away from premarital sex, drugs, and success in school is that they eat with their families a sit-down meal twice a week. Twice a week.
The new book, Brain Rules, which is a New York Times bestseller, will say the exact same thing.
Yeah. Dr. John, if you Medina actually can have a child sit with you at a table and have a meal, they will actually have a off-the-charts potential of not getting into drugs, not getting into gang activity, and actually doing well in academics.
I had dinner with John Medina about a year ago, and I asked him that question. He said, the number one thing I would recommend is that you eat together as a family. It's what we know right now.
The literal patience of sitting at a table and having conversation together is the only real time in human space that many children will have in their entire day. Everything's accelerated. You drive 60 miles an hour and listen to a podcast. You journey on Google searches at speeds that are unfathomable. But to actually have this conversation in real time, to allow for mundane moments, to have for patience, to chew your food before you speak, to sit in place and wait for somebody else to get off from the table. We're not a success in our family yet, but we're working there. You know, this is a lesson in how to actually be a human being. And this is why Jesus sat at everybody's table throughout the New Testament. He wanted to teach them how to sit down, be quiet, have a meal together, and learn what it meant to be human again.
I might say, like, hospitality is considered the largest industry in the world right now. And by and large, I feel like hospitality is dying, if not almost entirely dead. It's traded as a commodity. It's treated as a commodity. And hospitality is meant to be a relationship. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't happen so much anymore, which is frightening.
Tragic.
Cammy. Your question or comment?
Hi. A question for you, Mark. So once a year, we live on Queen Anne, and there is an amazing Burger Fest barbecue, and Canlis puts it on. And I am curious as to what type of meat all of our burgers have. And it is incredible. You guys have all the fixins, everything, and it's amazing that you do that for our community. and the kids and I totally appreciate it.
It's from Costco, Cammy. I'm sorry to tell you this.
You're not supposed to mention that public. We do free burgers for the community, and we don't announce the date because we can't afford to really do it for everyone. But last year, about 1,700 people showed up, and all of that meat was from Gleason Ranch, and specifically our butcher, whose name is Tracy Smodges, who works with a number of different farmers through Washington State. And a small portion of that actually is pig, which is why those burgers taste so good. little secret there, but a lot of pork in there as well. Now the secret's out.
We're good. I mean, come on, meatballs? There got to be a lot of different meats.
Some of that is actually filet and New York scrap that the restaurant produces at the ends of the loins and whatnot. And we save that up, freeze it, and then grind it. Yep.
Pigs and cows living together. End of time stuff.
Going to move to Queenan.
All right. Roger, what's your question?
Are there diets from other countries that are intrinsically healthy?
Yes. Most of them?
Most of them. Well, the Mediterranean diet in particular, as more of studies have come out, is because it's very high in omega-3s, which are good for your arteries, good for your heart, good for your brain. In fact, they've done studies on pregnant women who are taking omega-3s and the health of their babies and their IQs and all these sorts of things. But the Mediterranean diet has a lot of that in there, a lot of olive oil, a lot of olives, a lot of healthy lean meats.
Yeah, generally, the further north you get, the little trickier it is. My brother lives in Scotland. He's a pastor up there. It's harder to eat up there. It really is. There's a lot of good fish, which is healthy. There's a lot of grain. There's some decent beef, but it's trickier. It's easier when the weather's a little bit warmer. So I think you'll find, and I want to be, I'm gingerly stepping here, the closer you are to the Mediterranean, or at least if you have all four seasons, you're going to find healthier diets, more or less. But I would say to that point, because I want to make this again. The French eat slower than we do, and they eat real food more often than we do. And real food is healthy. I don't care what you're eating, how much fat is in it. It's good for you. It doesn't matter
by
where
real
it came
food,
from, as long as it's
define
real.
Real food for us, Mark. Are you saying that the corn industrial produced is not real
corn
food?
Corn is great for you. I love corn. In manufactured, industrialized, processed foods are not so good for you. Just by and large, I think we're going to find that over time, over and over and over again. And if that hasn't already been proven.
Can I give also just another prop for the East as well, the mm-hmm, Far East, mm-hmm. in the Okinawa region, yeah. right? So the island of Okinawa has statistically been the lowest rates of heart disease, the lowest rates of cancers. And the threefold things that you find in Okinawa is a high use of fish that's caught, mm-hmm. right? So wild fish, right? Rice as opposed to other types mm-hmm. of grains, right? And a lack of sedentary lifestyle. Yeah. As a testimonial here, I mean, when I moved to Scotland, not having a car, for a good portion of the year, I lost 20 pounds just by not having a car. Yeah, if you want to park your car, eat real food, you'll save your life.
Wow. Okay. Colleen, you get the last question tonight. We've run out of time.
Oh, goodness. The pressure's on. So we've been talking a lot about our individual choices, and I really think that there's a huge systemic problem. So I quit buying Chiquita bananas because they're not locally grown, and there's a farmer in Ecuador somewhere that's out of a job. I mean, there's not quite that correlation, but, I mean, we can be local to the point that we're harming then people who are much poorer than I am. I mean, I'm not rich, but a banana farmer, a day laborer in Ecuador makes nothing. So I'm just curious for you guys to think out loud about kind of the ethics of the in-between while we're working on systemic change, while we're trying to make good choices. But, sometimes we need to make choices remembering that we're global citizens and not just local
sure.
citizens.
Can we switch it from bananas to something that'll hit home a little more? Does anyone drink coffee? Right? Second largest traded commodity in the world behind oil. How many of you really pay attention to the way your coffee was sourced? 1, 2, 3, 4, right? A half a dozen. Coffee's a big deal. And oh, by the way, Starbucks is a pretty safe place to go get your coffee from. So you can feel proud about that. I don't know of a coffee company.
And giving
doing
free
more.
Wi-Fi as of
And getting free Wi-Fi. It doesn't hurt.
A major breakthrough at Starbucks.
So I think that your point's well taken, is that we. the America plays an important role in the global economy and supporting them, and I think that we have a responsibility to do that wisely and to do it prudently and to do it with a lot of discernment and a lot of care. I think when we get careless is where we as a nation get in trouble. And coffee's coming around a little bit. You'll see that happening, I think, in the next few years, I hope.
And pollen actually talks about that as well. You know, do I buy this organic pepper in the middle of winter? Or it's asparagus, I think.
Because
organic asparagus from Chile. Okay, well, now that patch of ground in Chile doesn't have pesticides on it because I bought this asparagus. But he says in the book that the asparagus was tasteless. So, it is that balancing act of, you know, what is most important to you, you know, in this meal? And if it's helping farmers in Chile, then buy the asparagus.
Well, I want to thank all of you on our panel tonight, Mark Canlis for making a trip back today and including us in his evening, and Jenny Spohr and Dr. Jeff Hughes, have I mentioned, tenured professor.
Everybody drink.
And as always, did I mention Jeff is speaking at Kindlings Fest this summer, too? We always ask each of our guests to make one final comment in concluding our show. And let's start with Mark and then Jenny and Jeff. Final comment.
A tradition I was not familiar with. But
and you get to
welcome
start.
To the family.
Yeah, exactly.
One final comment. Let's see. I'll make a final comment. I think that people are a lot like plants. I think they take nurturing, forming, and cultivating relationships is sort of what we do as people. I think that Pollen's book is a battle cry for us in the way that we eat and a wake-up call to us. And I think it's a good first step maybe to the way that we treat our marriages and our children and our neighbors that live next to us. Those are the neighbors I'm talking about, the ones that may be foreign to you all. I think that this is the beginning of a discussion, a larger discussion about cultivating relationships with people. And I think that trust being the basis of those relationships, there's a lot of that we can still form yet. As a country, I think that as the way we've eaten has changed, so has the way that we relate with one another has changed. And that's the two are intertwined in a way that I don't fully understand but believe is really important to who we are as a country. So.
Jenny.
That was really good. Nice newbie final comment. You know, it's been mentioned a lot tonight about some of the poverty issues and justice issues, and those justice issues are dear to my heart, as many of you know. But I think a lot of this does boil down to kind of a bourgeois angst that we have about eating, and most of the listeners, most people in the room are kind of in that bourgeois, you know, middle class, upper middle class, and I think because we have the resources, and because we have the time, or can make the time, that you really should start to think a little bit more intentionally about not only how you eat, but how you serve it, and how you do come around the table. Bake a pie. Go this weekend. Just bake a pie. Make that crust from scratch. Use a little leaf lard or some local butter.
Bring it to a talk show host.
Just make a pie and bring it exactly. And bring it with you. No, just even something as simple as baking, you know, a pie. I think it brings you back. This is my baker roots coming out. It just will bring you back to the table, and you'll be surprised at how many people will want to sit and eat at your table with a homemade pie coming out.
Our church annual meeting, they told me 20 years ago, they got tired of having cantankerous meetings. So they said, I got an idea. Let's have a pie social. Everybody bring pie. And ever since they did it, the meetings last like 10 minutes because everybody wants to get to all the homemade pies.
That's
so, like,
right.
No problems with the church anymore because we want our pie.
The pie is a peacemaker.
Said, I know the only thing standing between you and your pie is me. So let's move this meeting along. It's true.
Totally. Pie is the great peacemaker. I believe it. I believe it.
The gospel.
Of Quentin.
Amen. There's my book.
By the way, before Jeff comes up with his tenured professor from Seattle Pacific University closing comment, when we were creating this show, I went and talked to Martin Marty, who's a friend of mine, a church historian. And I said our aim was to have intelligent, imaginative conversations about ideas that matter. And I was tired with kind of hostile talk and frivolous talk and everything else. And And Marty said, I would urge you to add one word, hospitable. He said every major world religion and every important culture throughout all of history has considered hospitality at the heart of the human and transcendent relationship. And so we added the Kindling's Muse as an attempt at intelligent, hospitable, imaginative explorations of ideas that matter. And I think about that every time. And I love it at the breaks when this room comes alive with conversation at all these tables over food. And it's just a cool thing to see happening, sometimes with people that have never known each other before. And it's kind of what we've been trying to get at in a way tonight, is these are things that we can do in our homes. We can do with friends. We can do them, you know, not just on vacation, but on weekend events and every night events with our kids. Now, Jeff.
Well, I'll give my space over to Jesus. How's that one?
Are we going back to corn dogs?
Yeah, we are. We are.
Okay. He would eat them.
So probably one of the most famous meals in history was the Last Supper. And when Jesus invited these disciples together, these friends together, you know, around this table, and instituted this, what we call the Eucharist, in Luke's gospel, Jesus institutes it in such a way that he ends this grand discourse of this meal, this body and blood, and brings us all together. And he says, do this in remembrance of me. You know, Luke 22:19. In the Greek, it's a tatopoiete anamethane. And the poiete is the do this part. And that word poiete is where we get the word poetry in English. It's a creative act. It's in the Greek, an ergo is to create a functional, structured, just do it efficiently as fast as possible. And I think that's like ergonomics, you know, it's an ergonomic machine, right? It chunks stuff out. And I think a lot of our meals and the way we deal food is chunking stuff out. It's very ergo. But Jesus said poiete. You know, poiete anamethane. When you remember me, be creative about food. Remember me. Create a space where we can talk to each other and create community together. And that was the great, great moment of Jesus' ministry when he said, if I'm going to leave anything with you, it's going to be this. Sit around a table and remember me. And do it with creativity. And don't do it merely as just this thing to get through. And I think that is one of the great moments that I want to just remember us with as well.
Well, it's been an interesting conversation tonight. In the book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, French gastronomist Anthelme Brillat-Savarin says, tell me what you eat and I will tell you what you are. And Michael Pollan said, the answer is, you are corn. So in the famous words of Irma Bombeck, I am not a glutton, I am an explorer of food. Be an explorer of food and hospitality. Thanks to all of our guests tonight. Thanks to all of you for joining us on the Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. Join us next time.
There we go.